Hello, welcome to the Lowy Institute. Very good to see you here. Big crowd for this time of year, so thank you all very much for coming. I'm Steve Grenville, I'm a visiting fellow here. Just two little rules, or maybe three little rules. We're going to stop at 1:15, so if I stop you, it's not anything personal, it's just that we always stop at 1:15. And mobiles off, please. We're going to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership today. For my part, I think the starting point is to assume that it's going to go ahead, and this is what I'm looking for from today's session. I can divide it up into economics, politics, and strategic or global issues. On economics, the starting point for me is that the one thing that economists agree on is that free trade is a good idea. We've never managed to convince anyone else, non-economists, but for economists, that's one of the truths. The TPP, on the other hand, is much more difficult to assess. It's a preferential trade agreement, so in a sense, all bets are off with the usual rules. We've got to look a lot more closely. We've got to look in particular at trade diversion. And of course, the TPP is to a very large extent about behind-the-border issues. Most of the countries in the TPP have actually got their tariffs down. In Australia's case, more than 90% of our tariffs are below 5%. I find that just an amazing idea, that in the last 25 or 30 years we've gone from a tariff-ridden economy to an economy with almost no tariffs. So tariffs are not the big deal, at least for Australia. Behind-the-border issues are much harder to assess. We haven't got this simple economist rule that says it's Pareto optimal in the sense that the winners could overcompensate the losers. So we've got to look more carefully at the individual items. And the sorts of things that have been controversial here have been the dispute settlement, what I call ISDS, but sometimes you hear different letters for that. Intellectual property, always a difficult issue. There have to be winners and losers with intellectual property. And then a whole lot of issues like the environment, labour standards. In labour standards, for instance, it's not a foolish idea that different countries have different labour standards, and countries with lower living standards than ours ought to be entitled to take advantage of the comparative advantage which they have through cheap labour costs. So we've got to assess these things in terms of what they do to the basic economics. Now, the politics is all about winners and losers, coalitions, how it's gone in Canberra. The issue that, for me, and particularly relevant to the Lowy Institute, are the strategic or global issues. I think there's one word here that springs to mind, and that's China. China is not a member. Question is this a containment policy of China, for China? Us versus them? If it is that a good idea? Where do we go from here on China? There are also other issues here. There's a question of whether putting in place this platinum set of rules might actually encourage the members to have better rules. It might be a push for reform in these countries, in the same way that our membership of the OECD in the 1980s was part of the push for reform. It's very useful to have the OECD shouting at us from outside and saying, you should do this and you should do that. So maybe these platinum standard rules might actually help. There's an issue about if we decided that it was a bad idea, would it be sensible in political terms not to sign up, with an agreement which is obviously so important to our great and powerful friend, America? Are there really big losses involved in not signing up? And then perhaps in the same issue of political issues, we ought to think about what happens to the other trade-related institutions. Where is the poor old WTO in all of this? And perhaps more importantly for us in Australia, where are the Asian-oriented trade deals going? RCEP, Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. Did I get that right? Anyway, this is the Asian one, and that should be in the debate somewhere. Whenever we're talking about Asia, we should also remember that ASEAN is very important to our near neighbours. So a discussion that doesn't have the centrality of ASEAN in it, somewhere in the discussion, doesn't seem to me to get much traction there. So, who have we got here? Fine panel today. Jessica Irvin, who carries on what seems to me to be a grand tradition in the Fairfax Press, Ross Gittins, Peter Martin, explaining economics to the general public, the thing that economists do so badly at, and Jessica's carrying on that grand tradition. Leon Berkelmans, who's the director of the International Economic Program here and also the head of the G20 Studies Centre, and Luke Nottage, who's the professor of comparative and transnational law at Sydney University. Many other things in his CV, I was interested to see how many to do with Japan. But we're not talking about Japan today. We're going to talk about the TPP. So, Jessica.
Thanks, Steve. I thought I might just address my opening remarks by addressing the question posed by the panel discussion today, which is free trade agreements, transformative, terrible, or tedious? And I have to tell you that from the media perspective, it's the latter. I remember my first encounter with reporting on free trade happened a decade ago. As a cadet at the SMH, I was sent to cover a Chinese delegation who had arrived in Sydney to kick off talks for the China FTA. And we sat around the table and all the parties, including the sort of Australian trade delegation, expressed their optimism that we would conclude a free trade agreement by the end of the year. And I rushed back to my editors and said, "Ooh, we're going to have a free trade agreement with China by the end of the year." And that was 2005. And my editor gave me a talking down and said, yes, there's ways to report on free trade agreements, and believing the statements about when they'll be concluded is not the way to go about it. That's so I was surprised, pleasantly surprised, to find out that a decade later, you know, the government had sealed an agreement with China on the free trade agreement, and China and Japan and South Korea added to those. And so we are talking about free trade agreements and adding in the TPP now. But I just, for some context, urge us all to remember the politics of it, which is that the government needs an economic positive story to sell. And they've decided upon the free trade agreements because, if you ask economists what is the number one economic achievement of the Abbott government, we should say, they do say the free trade agreements, because economists think they're an unequivocal good, and because they can't think of anything else. Unfortunately, budget repair, tax reform, there's not much of a story to sell there. So the $25 million campaign that is underway to advertise the FTAs, I've written about, you know, I think it's highly politicised that it carries the tag Open for Business, which runs perilously close, I think, to Tony Abbott's election night winning slogan of Open for Business. So I think that we will, under the new administration, see a bit of a toning down of the talk on free trade agreements. Maybe we'll hear less about them, which is not to say that they aren't important achievements. And, you know, what we were talking about, my role in the media of trying to explain economics to people, I do point out that there are benefits for us when other countries drop their tariffs. The TPP is different because we already have bilateral free trade agreements with, I think, 9 out of the 12 countries. So in terms of eliminating tariffs, we're already getting a pretty good deal from most of those countries. So it is the China deal, the Japan deal that will probably yield the biggest benefits for us, you know, eliminating tariffs on our dairy, on our beef. That became very important because China was signing deals with our competitors like New Zealand to eliminate tariffs on their goods going to China. So if we hadn't have entered into a bilateral agreement, we would have been at a competitive disadvantage. So there are winners in terms of our agriculture, producers shipping off to China and Japan. So we can't be too cynical about these things, although I would say that the biggest winners that seem to come out of these free trade agreements are all the bureaucrats at DFAT that get to keep their job for they've had a job for 10 years out of the China agreement, and all the international trade lawyers who will make a mozzer, no doubt, out of the ISDS provisions and testing those. So cynicism, well-placed cynicism, but, you know, I come down on the side of tedious but slightly transformative is where I position.
Thanks, Jessica. Thanks very much. That gets us underway. Leon.
So I would say, first of all, yes, tedious, but there's a bit of terrible thrown in there, a dash of terrible. So I'll talk about my position. If we think about the upsides, my general line on these things is that there are some upsides associated with them, but they're not worth the downsides that come with these agreements. So let me just talk about the upsides that these things deliver. So as Jessica mentioned, there's reductions in tariffs and some non-tariff barriers. The modelling that gets done for that suggests that the benefits are pretty small. So for the combination of the three bilateral trade agreements that we've signed recently, this is China, Japan and Korea, the modelling suggests, that was done by the Centre for International Economics, suggests that that will boost GDP by something of the order of 0.05% to 0.1%. So that's just a little small kick there. The TPP, there's been various iterations of modelling done there. For Australia, the initial modelling suggested that maybe it was going to lead to a 0.2% increase in GDP. Later modelling, when they introduced a few more bells and whistles to what was going on in the model, suggested that maybe the boost was going to be something like 0.6%. So 0.2% to 0.6%, depending on the model. That's a little bit chunkier, but I don't think it's worth the downside. So let me talk about the thing that really, I don't know whether upsets me, it concerns me the most in the trade agreements, and that's the intellectual property provisions. So when we sign on to these agreements, we typically are signing on to more stringent intellectual property protections than we have on our books. Or if we're not doing that, we're committing to and we're solidifying the existing high protections for intellectual property that we already have in place. Now, I think that's a bad thing. And it's a bad thing for two reasons. One is that Australia is a net importer of intellectual property. So that means that when we grant higher protections to the owners of that property, we have to pay more money to them. So we lose out there. But the second thing that I think is especially damaging is that I think a fair reading of the economic literature suggests that we're at a point where increasing intellectual property provisions actually reduces innovation. Intellectual property is supposed to be there to increase innovation. It's supposed to be the case that if you put research into a certain product, you're granted some sort of monopoly privileges to give you some incentive to do that research. That's sort of a textbook way it might work, but there are other things going on. Companies may use patents to block innovation from other companies. And that seems to be what is going on. The economic literature on this seems to suggest, this is my reading of it, seems to suggest that we are at that space, that increased intellectual property protections at the moment reduce innovation. If they reduce innovation, they will reduce growth. They will reduce economic growth. And that, so because innovation is the major source of economic growth. So if these things are reducing growth, that's going to easily outweigh any of those sort of little one-shot bumps that we get from the reduction in trade barriers that I mentioned before. It's easily going to overwhelm, you could easily think that it will overwhelm the 0.05% bump in GDP that we're getting from those, for example, three bilateral free trade agreements. I'm also, another thing that I'm very uncomfortable with as an economist about these free trade agreements are the investor-state dispute settlement mechanisms. So these are where foreign companies can take a given government to a tribunal if the government has reneged on any sort of commitment or something like that. This, as an economist, this sort of makes you very uncomfortable to begin with, because you're giving foreign companies giving them rights that domestic companies don't have. So initially that starts making you very uncomfortable. There is a way to justify these things, and there is a way that they might work. The idea is that these things get governments to basically commit to not behaving badly and therefore increase foreign direct investment, and that's a good thing. But again, my reading of the evidence, and maybe we can talk about that evidence a little later on, is that that actually does not happen. So my general feeling is that these things are not worth the downsides to them. There is an alternative. What we can do is unilaterally liberalise. We can cut all our tariffs and non-tariff barriers ourselves, and we get most of the benefit from these agreements through that path. So, for example, the Productivity Commission did some modelling a number of years ago looking at the liberalisation, just unilateral liberalisation, saying that this would increase GDP in Australia by 0.6%. That, if you recall, was sort of at the upper end of that range for the TPP I mentioned, 0.2 to 0.6%. But the key thing here is that that modelling done by the TPP was much more of the vintage of the 0.2% number. It had much more in common, that modelling had much more in common with the modelling that gave the 0.2% number for the TPP. So we can unilaterally liberalise, we get three times the benefit, if you want to use those numbers, we get three times the benefit we would from the TPP, and we don't get those things that I think are damaging.
Thanks, Leon. Luke.
Thank you. Yeah, so I'm with Jessica on this point in the sense that I think free trade agreements are certainly tedious, but a little bit transformative. As I emailed you beforehand, I think free trade agreements, to paraphrase Winston Churchill, are the sort of worst form of trade and investment liberalisation mechanism, except for all the others. No, and I'm sorry, but unilateral liberalisation, I think, has reached its limit. It was a lot more effective in the 80s when, as Steve indicated, you know, countries like Australia were heavily regulated and there was sort of a lot of obvious low-hanging fruit where, you could just on a unilateral basis liberalise certain sectors and get clear net economic gains and political momentum to do that sort of thing. Even through the 1990s, that was true, and also in some of our neighbouring countries. And so APEC was very effective in jawboning and sort of getting people on the same page in terms of appreciating those opportunities. And of course, in those days, you know, there was a big boost to those sort of unilateral measures, because there was this recently liberalised world trading system thanks to the implementation of the WTO from 1995. It made it easier to sell the message that unilateral liberalisation will lead to that sort of economic growth opportunity. Unfortunately, you know, I don't think we're really in that era and haven't been for a while, in the sense that, the low-hanging fruit has gone, and certainly in a lot of countries like Australia, and now we're just talking about, you know, 0.something% to go that extra little mile. And if we're thinking about risks, well, in some of these countries that have unilateral liberalised, like the financial markets in the US before the global financial crisis, that didn't really work out that well for their economy or the world economy. So there are risks associated too with unilateral liberalisation. If we look at the multilateral level, as Steve mentioned, the WTO has been negotiating multilaterally for 15 years to try to, even on a narrow agenda, further liberalise, say, in services trade and so on. And, there's a little bit of movement finally for a plurilateral agreement for services, but certainly nothing in the field that Leon has raised of, say, investment. The WTO does have a mode of investment through in services sectors, which provides for non-discriminatory market access if countries commit to opening up their certain services sectors, but there's no multilateral agreement to protect and liberalise investments overall, and frankly, no prospect of it through the WTO or other forums like the OECD. They tried in the late 90s and got badly burnt and haven't revived that agenda there either. And so in investment, you've been left with trying to further protect existing investments, encourage further and better quality foreign direct investment, and also to liberalise access across the board for foreign investors through bilateral investment treaties and more recently investment chapters and free trade agreements. And I'm not saying that, you know, we should just blithely proceed down the road of concluding and drafting and implementing FTAs without holding accountable the politicians and the negotiators of the treaties. I think, you know, I think DFAT officials would far rather do other things than negotiate these treaties. And some of the politicians, I mean, I feel a bit sorry for Andrew Robb going around the world endlessly and trying to clinch these deals, which he has done in recent years. But we should hold them accountable and look carefully at what's being included in those treaties. And it's much more complex, as Steve mentioned, than the simple economic problem of, you know, bringing down discriminatory barriers to trade in the form of tariffs, you know, which you've got a problem now of trying to set a balanced and enforceable set of property rights, whether it's for intellectual property or foreign investment property rights, where you've got competing interests, like with IP, as Leon said, you're trying to encourage more and better innovation by encouraging investments, by offering certain IP protections, but not going too far to undermine that objective. And likewise with investment. So with the investment chapters, the question is trying to include substantive protections like non-discrimination, but also some basic minimum standards such as expropriation, generating adequate compensation, or provisions that commit host states not to deny justice before local courts or administrative tribunals to foreign investors, especially in countries where those mechanisms to protect investments and investors' property rights don't meet sort of widely accepted international standards, which are then entrenched through treaties. And the ISDS mechanism is just an extra procedure that's put in there to more credibly commit the host state to abiding by those commitments. On top of that, in all treaties, you know, investment treaties, there is an interstate arbitration process similar to the WTO mechanism for trade disputes. You know, and interestingly, no one seems to be at all worried about that. So from a legal perspective, it's just an extra procedure that underpins, the ISDS mechanism is just an extra legal procedure that underpins the substantive protections that are committed to by the host states.
Thanks, Luke. And the speakers have been so disciplined that I'm going to come back to them so that they can reply to each other. But I want to see if there are any first responders in the audience, people with urgent issues. I'm hoping to get Meriden at some stage to ask about China, because no one's mentioned China, and you'll get sick of it if I keep saying that China's an issue. But anyone in the audience who wants to come in? Thank you. One starter already. Microphone. Sorry. Wait for the microphone.
Pete Bannister.
And tell us who you are, please.
Yeah, Pete Bannister, retired government economist from here in Sydney. A month ago, I was in Chongqing at the International Road Federation Congress and got up talking about possible PPP suggestions for China, they were pretty keen. Second last slide of mine raised the subject of investor-state dispute resolution. No one, and then this is in an audience of 500 or more people, really picked up on it. An interesting thing. They must be aware of it, but none of those people at the International Road Federation Congress got it. Yet they talked about toll roads, contracts which would have bound their government bodies because it would be at a subnational level that the government party would be. That's what I saw a month ago.
Thanks, Peter. I'm going to take a few questions if I can find them first. I've got ISDS wrapped around that question, so we'll be looking to you in a moment, Luke. But have we, any other first responders? Please wait for the microphone.
I'm just interested to hear comment. Does the free trade agreement extend to professional standards in all the different professions?
So just make sure I understand that question. So dentists from, now, it's a bit invidious to actually mention countries, but a particular country with perhaps lower standards of dentistry would be allowed to come and practice in Australia.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll take other questions. I'll take three questions for a start. Over here, please, but wait for the microphone, please.
I've got two questions. The first one is a question of layman, but nevertheless, I'd like to ask it. What are the relations between bilateral free trade agreements and multilateral ones? For example, Australia and Japan reached the free trade agreement. Later, they became a partners in the TPP agreement. Does it mean that TPP agreement will make the former bilateral agreement in a way obsolete? And my second question is about WTO. Let's imagine for a moment that the TPP agreement would be hugely successful. Later, Indonesia, maybe even China will join in. Will it make the WTO destiny in a way, I don't know, very fragile, let's say, or maybe WTO would be dead in 10 or 15 years? Thank you.
Thank you. Now, the first question, I think, obviously starts with Luke, although the others might want to come in.
So, yes, good question about the mood and perception of investor-state dispute settlement mechanisms in from a Chinese perspective. I think China was originally quite closed to inbound foreign investment, and accordingly, you know, thinking back to the 80s, even the 90s, but the 80s especially, and so they were very cautious in entering into investment treaties. And so, for example, one of the first for Australia was with the People's Republic of China, and, you know, China and Australia committed mutually to not expropriate and not engage in discriminatory treatment and so on. But the ISDS mechanism was limited to questions relating to the amount of compensation if there was an expropriation. And some, depending on the wording used, you can construct an argument and allow the tribunal sometimes to question about, to decide whether or not there'd actually been an expropriation as well. But that was it. You couldn't enforce the non-discrimination procedures through the bilateral Australia-China BIT through the ISDS mechanism. You had to just rely on interstate arbitration. Interestingly, that's not much changed under the Australia-China FTA. That's extended the ISDS mechanism to the national treatment discrimination, anti-discrimination provisions, but it doesn't allow for ISDS to be added, say, for a breach of justice in Chinese courts for Australian investors, which might be a bit of a worry for some or not. But China, on the whole, as it's become also a greater outbound investor, has changed its attitude to investment treaties generally, and particularly to ISDS, and for the last 10 years has been actually quite pushing quite hard to include a broad ISDS protection for all the substantive commitments. So, for example, in 2008, New Zealand and China concluded an FTA that had a full-blown protections for foreign investors on both sides, plus a full-blown ISDS mechanism. There have been a few claims by Chinese investors, one against Peru, another here and there and so on, but not many by Chinese outbound investors. The difference with Australia, I think, is that there hasn't yet been a major ISDS claim against China, which we know from other countries, including Australia, really changes the mood. And especially if we can imagine a US investor or US-linked company bringing a claim against China and succeeding, I think, you know, there would be a lot of media, social media attention and so on. But I doubt whether the Chinese government would say, oh, because of this one case, we're going to completely rethink the risks associated with actually being sued ourselves under this extra mechanism. And so I'm not surprised, frankly, that, you know, in China it's not an issue. I know in Korea there was a little bit of an issue when a US-linked company brought a case against, which is still pending, the first ever treaty claim against, in relation to a nationalised financial institution brought indirectly by a US Wall Street firm. The opposition at the time got very upset about this and was around the time of the actual ratification of the Korea-US FTA, which had been negotiated actually by the opposition when it was still in government, including full-on ISDS. And so, and there was a presidential election in Korea. And so there was a lot of discussion then for a while, a year or two, but now they're back to including ISDS mechanisms in their treaties, including with Korea this year and Australia as well. And Korea, of course, is interested in joining the TPP, very interested, and they're expecting and perfectly comfortable with the ISDS mechanism. And that sort of ties into the question later about the TPP perhaps you know, multilateralizing, and so as well as Korea and possibly China, we have strong interest expressed from Indonesia. Well, not strong, but interest from Indonesia and also Philippines and Thailand in our region. And the TPP is sort of pushing the negotiators of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which does already include China, the ASEAN Plus 6 FTA, to sort of meet more regularly and try to bring that to a conclusion, because those members that are not yet part of the TPP concerned that they're missing out and so on, and want to fast, you know, accelerate the negotiations for that other Asia Pacific agreement. Plus, of course, you've got the US that's negotiating the transatlantic agreement with Europe, the TTIP, and that's going to, you know, have to get a boost from what's happened with the TPP.
Thanks, Luke. It's certainly true that when you get one of these cases, it focuses the mind, and of course the one that focused the minds in the case of Australia was the Philip Morris case, where they objected to our so-called plain packaging. They don't look very plain packaged to me when I look at a cigarette box now, but you know what it's about. And by and large, there was very strong public support for that program, and in a sense that was the sovereign right of Australia to introduce some laws which did some damage to companies like Philip Morris. So when China gets a case like the Philip Morris case, then more people will know about it. Now, who wants to... You could have another go at ISDS, but I ought to move on to some of these others. Anyone want to have a go on professional standards?
I can say something quickly about it. Yep. So I don't hold grave concerns for the, if we're talking about people operating in Australia, I don't have grave concerns that they wouldn't be meeting standards or something like that. I think the protections here are fine. What I would say about that is about the issue of professional services is that there's a degree of hype about those things. in terms of our ability to export those things, especially with the China Free Trade Agreement. So we heard a lot about how this agreement was going to open up all sorts of opportunities for service providers, professional services, aged care services, those kinds of things. I'm very sceptical that those things are going to be big winners. There may be the odd company here or there that does very well, but overall services are not as traded as goods, and I very much doubt the capacity of a lot of Australian companies to go over in to China and make a good fist of it. Operating in China is difficult. There are language barriers, there are cultural barriers, there's all kinds of things. You need a very, very particular set of skills, and I'm sceptical that a lot of Australians have those skills.
I was just going to say on the issue of the multilateral versus bilateral agreements, my understanding is that the bilateral agreements tend to be more ambitious in their scope in terms of reducing tariffs, and therefore they would be the primary, correct me if I'm wrong, all those concessions and agreements would be primary, and then the TPP, the multilaterals, are sort of add-ons on top. And that for us, the bilaterals are where most of the hard work is done in reducing barriers. In terms of whether it makes it harder to get a global agreement, you know, a global free trade agreement, I see some parallels with the climate change debate. And actually, what seemed to be the best hope for a market-based mechanism to tackle climate change was to have all these country-based emissions trading schemes that would eventually be linked up. Our trading scheme is going to link up with New Zealand, we can link up with California, you know, China, and that this sort of bottom-up organic sort of it's like what's the big blob that just sort of keeps rolling and picks up extra bits as it goes along, because just setting out with a piece of paper and trying to get every single country to agree to something is just going to be impossible. So I would hope that you just sort of see these things grow like weeds, and that the sort of the map of bilateral agreements starts to look like the, you know, the airplane, global airplane map. There's one going that way and one going that way, and eventually it's a thick forest. I don't know if you would agree if that's the way things will go and get competing multilaterals.
I don't know what will happen. There's lots of, if we're talking about what's written academically about this stuff, there's theory that suggests that these things are building blocks towards multilateral reform. There's other theory that it's a stumbling block, that all we end up with is, I think the metaphor is a spaghetti bowl that was coined by Bhagwati in the early 90s. Look, I don't know, but if we do end up, if, say, the TPP ends up growing, then the thing that I think is really damaging from that is the IP, is the intellectual property, because this is adopting what's called a TRIPS plus basic approach, right? So under the WTO, we have TRIPS, which is basic multilateral minimum standards for intellectual property. The agreements that we're signing now have higher degrees of protection, and so if the TPP grows and if the TPP becomes pan-Asian and then global, then that's locking in these higher intellectual property standards.
Thanks, Leon. I'm looking for more questions now.
I wonder if you could comment quickly on this idea of the sovereign national interest and this idea of corporate interest maybe overriding or clashing with that. Sort of what your take is on that. Is that important, or is that being exaggerated in the media, or sort of I'd be interested in hearing your opinion.
And this is something I was trying to pin you down, Luke, on. Does it make it easier in any sense for a foreign company to sue our government? Is it exactly the same possibility post a TPP, or is it slightly, because it does establish a new tribunal, it's likely to be tested? Whether it succeeds is then another
two different questions. Is it exactly the same? No. There's an extra option, say, for a US company, or for that matter, a Japanese company, or a Japanese individual, to bring a claim in relation to their investment accepted, admitted, made in Australia through the ISDS mechanism that's added through the TPP, which wasn't included in the bilateral agreement, to get back to an earlier question, right? So that's now an extra avenue. So just logically, there is more scope. How much more? I don't think a lot more, because you already had rights, very similar protections in earlier treaties through an interstate mechanism, like if you're a foreign investor and you find that, you know, the state government in Australia is stuffed up because maybe they didn't get advice from Canberra about existing international law commitments and requirements, you know, you could go to your home state and get them to start an interstate dispute, just like in the WTO system if you're an exporter of goods or services. However, you know, that mechanism doesn't always work, as we know, because there may be other diplomatic reasons why a government doesn't want to bring an interstate dispute through an investment treaty or an FTA or the WTO, right? But now, of course, if you've got ISDS, the foreign investor can bring the extra claim. But that extra risk, I think, is pretty minimal.
Which is
right?
Why
that's where I differ, say, from Leon, who's very risk-averse, having been a former central banker. I'm glad that central bankers are so risk-averse, thank you. But as someone whose first degree was in economics, with subsequent degrees were in law, and I come across, my everyday work involves looking at possible claims and actual claims in different forums, whether it's national courts or the WTO or investment tribunals now. You know, the fact that there might be another case doesn't worry me as much as Leon or perhaps Jessica.
Yeah, which
or
is why
the
as
average
a journalist,
member of the public.
As a journalist reporting what you just said, there's two options. You know, TPP will increase the risk that we're going
Professor
to be exposed
Nottage
to
says.
This. Says we're going to be exposed. Or I say, you know, Professor says there's only a very minor chance that this is going to do anything, and most journalists are probably going to opt for that first story. Which
right.
is why
in
I guess
fact, we've probably got time for one more question from the audience.
One very
all right, just before we start, Leon, going to be a
very
quick one
thing,
now.
Is that so? Luke mentioned the interstate arbitration. Those tribunals and the processes there are different to ISDS, and Luke's written a bit about that and about how the ISDS procedures should perhaps be reformed. So there's various things about the ISDS procedures that make me very uncomfortable. An example here is that someone who acts as counsel is in an ISDS case can then act as an arbitrator on the tribunal in another one, and then go back as acting as counsel in a following one. And then there's no appellate mechanism or anything like that. So the processes are different.
I'll just need to explain briefly on that.
I'm going to give you.
That's not correct, but under the WTO, it's a different system where there's an appellate.
Right. So I was
I'm going to give each of you 2 minutes afterwards, but we'll take this question quickly, please, and then you'll get 2 minutes each to defend yourselves.
Just quickly, assuming that TPP growth and more inclusion is a good thing, contrary to the IP argument, I've heard a lot of commentators say that some of the standards of the TPP are simply too high for many emerging nations to gain membership. Considering that, do you really think then our efforts should be more on a bilateral basis, and that the success of the TPP is going to be really limited in the future because of these high standards?
Thank you. Now, rather than answer that specifically, I'm going to give each of them, you've only got two minutes, and in the course of that, I'm hoping that one of them will pick that up very specifically. I'll start again with Jessica.
I can pick that up. I went on a US State Department sponsored junket to America 2 years ago to talk about the TPP. And what was interesting is, in addition to the 12, there was a journalist from each of the 12 countries, plus a journalist from China. And she would go along to every meeting and try to test, you know, the person we were interviewing as to whether they were serious about wanting to have China involved. She was very skeptical that the US even wanted the China to be part of the agreement. And the stock standard response was, of course we want you to be part. if you meet these very high standards for a rules-based, you know, market economy. And it seemed like the US people knew that those standards were going to be too high, but there was this lovely sort of open, well, of course you can join if you do this, and the Chinese people going, well, we would never do that, so you're not actually serious about having us come into the party. So whether China would ever be part of the TPP, I remain sceptical. There was not a lot of cultural understanding on our trip about, you know, whether how China would fit into the agreement.
Mm, thanks, Jessica. Leon, 2 minutes.
I don't think that I can claim to be any sort of expert on the internal politics of a lot of these other Asian economies. Let's just say a couple of things about Indonesia. So Jokowi said that he wants to join in, but I've talked to a number of Indonesian people who know Indonesia well, including Steve. So Steve may want to say a word or two about this. And a lot of those people are very sceptical that Indonesia will ever join. There's just it's too hard for the internal politics of it all. But there are, but then again, there might be some others. And I think Luke's talked to some of the others who know Indonesia well who have a different response. I don't know.
Thanks, Leon. Luke, 2 minutes.
Could I just add that, but we mustn't forget the EU in all of this. So the EU is finally also directing more attention to Asia, now part of the world, and looking to conclude some major bilaterals and perhaps even an agreement with ASEAN and so on. And they've gone through a lot of public consultation over different aspects of their FTAs, including investment treaties and ISDS. And recently have come up with an interesting reform proposal to have an international investment court with permanently staffed judges and an appellate mechanism built into the investment chapter, initially with the transatlantic sort of TTIP agreement with the US. But that might be very attractive also to certain other countries in the region, you know, that in our region, which are have some concerns about aspects of the procedure. It doesn't go to the substance, except to, you know, to make sure the arbitrators get reviewed for if they make a serious error of law. That would be an implication of this new mechanism as well. And I think that'd be very useful and worth thinking about, and it could be something that gets entrenched with certain countries in Asia with the EU. And if it's there in some form and between the US and the and Europe, then it's something that, you know, might catch on in other parts of the world, and sort of in 10 years it would be grafted into the Trans-Pacific Partnership or whatever even bigger Asia-Pacific FTA we have by then, or the new version of the WTO, right? But it would come through the EU. So these things are dynamic, and, you know, countries and regional groups come up with new interesting ideas, and it's a sort of marketplace of ideas and as well as geopolitics, and these things can take root. There's lots of examples of that in the way FTAs, investment treaties, have already evolved over the last 10 years compared to, you know, the early North American Free Trade Agreement in the early 90s.
Thanks, Luke. Well, here we are at the Lowy Institute of International Policy, and I hear economics and law here. I was hoping to hear more on the international aspects. For my part, I think of what Australia will be like in, say, 10 or 20 years' time. We'll be sitting in the part of the world which is growing fastest. China will be economically huge. We shouldn't forget the other countries which will also be economically huge, India and Indonesia. And those three and others are not in the TPP. I think this is a very important issue for Australia, more important for us perhaps than, say, for America thinking about China. So for my part, the one thing that I feel we didn't cover as well as I would have liked was what's holding China out, how this can be changed over time, whether Australia might have some role in changing that. I think of the situation now where America is not going to be rushing to get China in. You can see from the messages of President Obama, he talks about China adopting some of the good rules, but not actually being admitted to the club. I think of Indonesia. Well, Indonesia at the last minute thought, hey, we'd better say when Jokowi, President Jokowi is in Washington, we'd better be in favour of the TPP. But you look back at home, Vice President immediately says, no, we've got to focus on our own region and push forward with the RCEP, and in particular to make sure that ASEAN keeps its centrality. So I don't see the way forward in an international sense for us to use the TPP for the international relations that will be extremely important to us. I think the opportunity is there. America could understandably say we didn't want China when we were making the rules because it just made it too hard to get agreement. Now the rules have been reached. It's harder to get China in one way because China doesn't have any say in the rules. And yet, let's try. But America can't do it. America won't do it. Japan won't do it under current circumstances. So who's next in the list of TPP members to do it? Seems to me it's Australia, and we might use the opportunity over time to see what we could do to get China ready to come in. We have to stop now. We're on time. Lots of issues not solved, but I found it a very interesting discussion. This is going to go on. We heard from the Australian negotiator. The debate in Australia will probably go on for the next 2 years as they, DFAT and the minister, try to sell this idea to the Australian people. So there's plenty of room. The debate is not over just because the TPP is signed. The debate's not over. I hope we've taken it a bit further forward and hope you'll go on taking part in the debate. Could you join me in thanking the three panellists for this session?